Mr. Ambassador, Mr. Dean, Director of the Institute, distinguished colleagues, ladies and gentlemen. I'm delighted and privileged to welcome you here tonight to the first Douglas Johnson Memorial Lecture. It is sponsored by the UK Society for the Study of French History, in collaboration with the Association for the Study of Modern and Contemporary France, and the Institute of Historical Research at the University of London. When the distinguished Professor of French History at University College London, Douglas Johnson, died, it was said that it had been his life's work to help the British to understand the French and the French to understand Britain. That serves as the mission for this, what we intend to be, annual lecture dedicated to his memory. We're delighted that Mrs. Madeleine Johnson and members of the family are able to be with us this evening. Monsieur l'Ambassadeur, nous sommes très reconnaissants de tout votre investissement dévoué dans le rayonnement de la culture française à l'étranger et de la mise en valeur des atouts de votre pays afin qu'ils soient mieux compris et appréciés par d'autres. Cette mission culturelle se passe autour de l'organisation de colloques, de débats et de rencontres. Devant la crise actuelle dans les finances publiques, c'est pour les sociétés savantes comme les nôtres de devenir plus actives afin de réaliser cet objectif qui fut celui de Douglas Johnson lui-même. Et tout en vous remerciant très chaleureusement d'être avec nous ce soir, je vous assure de notre coopération fidèle à cet égard dans le domaine qui est le nôtre. The subject of this evening's lecture is more than appropriate to the inauguration of the series. Professor Johnson was the first British historian to be able to explain Charles de Gaulle's political principles in ways that the British could understand. This month, November 2010, is also a significant double anniversary, 120 years from Charles de Gaulle's birth and 40 years from his death. Professor Julian Jackson, who is beginning work on a major new biography of Charles de Gaulle for Penguin, explains that only now can we properly evaluate those principles and his achievement more broadly in the context of the century of Charles de Gaulle. Professor Jackson is a fellow of the British Academy and a shareholder at Queen Mary University of London since 2003. Many of you here will know his formative works on the impact of the Great Depression. In more recent years, his research interests have moved into the period after 1940. In 2001, he published an extensive synthesis of France under the occupation, shortlisted for the Los Angeles Times Book, History Book Prize, and translated into French in 2003. His most recent books include The Fall of France in 2003, one of the winners of the Wolfson History Prize, and his fascinating study of homosexual politics in France after 1945, Living in Arcadia. Julian, it's my very great pleasure to welcome you to give the first Douglas Johnson Memorial Lecture on the century of Charles de Gaulle.
Well, I'm very grateful for, the people who got here through this security, which is apparently due to fear of I thought it was because the ambassador was here, but in fact it's nothing to do with the ambassador. It's to do with fears of student unrest. So it's rather sort of reminiscent of 1968, which is what I'm going to talk about in this lecture. I make an apology at the beginning. I've decided that I would read this lecture and not actually extemporize it, I prefer to do, and it's never very nice to listen to a text, but at least that means it'll be over. It's a great honor to be invited to deliver the Douglas Johnson Memorial Lecture. Douglas was a legendary figure, incontournable, as the French say, for all those working on French history in this country. My first ever academic paper was delivered to his London seminar some 25 years ago, and from that time on, he was to me, as to many others, as to countless others, a constant source of encouragement and support. He made his reputation with a brilliant and monumental study of Guizot and went on to become a superb essayist on all matters French. His life, I had the same quotation from which I think perfectly encapsulates his life's work to help the British understand France and the French, France and the French, and vice versa. But his influence extended far beyond his published writings. There was nothing about France, and no one in France, whom Douglas did not seem to know. From his days at the sanatorium, for example, in École Normale Supérieure after the war, I remember him telling me how he had become a very close friend of Louis Althusser, and the picture of the two of them drinking in a London pub, as Douglas told me that they apparently used to do, was an image that always stuck in my mind. It was impossible to come away from a conversation with Douglas Johnson having not learned something new about France. Although often his insights were communicated in a seemingly throwaway anecdote, or an erudite, mischievous, witty, or elusive aside. Many people commented about Douglas that he cultivated a certain air of mystery and elusiveness. One moment he was there, and the next moment he was gone. For example, although he was a regular reader of L'Humanité and massively knowledgeable about the politics of the French Communist Party, I never got a clear answer from him what he actually thought of the French Communist Party. Well, I got an answer, but it wasn't an answer. But one thing was certainly not mysterious about Douglas, and that was his admiration for and encyclopedic knowledge about Charles de Gaulle. As one of his obituaries said, intellectually, Douglas Johnson became a kind of ambassador for Charles de Gaulle in Britain, starting with this classic article, 1965, The Political Principles of Charles de Gaulle, which still stands up very well today. It is appropriate, therefore, that when invited to deliver this lecture, I was given my title. I didn't choose the title, The Century of Charles de Gaulle. A title which I was happy to accept, although it is not a little intimidating for an Englishman to find himself lecturing on de Gaulle of all people in the presence of the French ambassador, who may be too young to have worked for the general himself, but who did work closely for the Gaullist Jacques Chirac, who had himself been in de Gaulle's government in 1968. And of course, one of his predecessors in London was Geoffroy de Courcelles, ambassador for 10 years from 1962, whom Douglas knew extremely well, who had been the only other Frenchman on that small plane that brought de Gaulle to London in 1940. I admit to being initially a bit sceptical about this lecture title. But during this year, which is the centenary of de Gaulle's, which is 120th, that's the 120th anniversary of de Gaulle's birth in 1990, the 70th anniversary of his 1940 appeal from London, and the 40th anniversary of his death in 1970, I've become amazed at the extent to which de Gaulle's memory looms ever larger in the collective consciousness of the French today. On the 18th of June this year, three television channels covered the anniversary celebrations live for several hours. Then 2 weeks ago, there was another bout of Gaulomania for the anniversary of de Gaulle's death. There were pilgrimages to de Gaulle's tomb at Colombelles des Églises by many politicians, including President Sarkozy, and documentaries on de Gaulle on every TV channel. One of these was followed by a three-hour debate in which figures ranging from Alain Delon to Jacques Lang were invited to give their own views of de Gaulle, where I stand in relation to de Gaulle. Le Monde ran a leader 2 weeks ago declaring that the French were still orphelins of de Gaulle, orphans of de Gaulle. An opinion poll carried out, An opinion poll carried out a few weeks ago by the Institut Charles de Gaulle shows how high de Gaulle now stands in the French national memory. Asked to choose the most important history in the figure of France, 44% of respondents chose de Gaulle. 70% he got 70% of first and second choices, far ahead of Napoleon, Charlotte, and the list is most peculiar, it has to be said. Far ahead of Charlemagne, Jaurès, qu'est-ce qu'il fait dans ses galères, Louis XIV, and Blum. How different this would have been from de Gaulle's own ranking, which we might come back to a little bit later. It is difficult to think of any other country where a historical figure continues to dominate contemporary consciousness in such a way. For all their historical importance, it would not be true to say that Roosevelt, for example, occupies a similar place in American memory, or de Valera in Irish memory. The Irish have other things on their mind at the moment. Even if in Spain, the 20th century might have been the century of Franco, in Germany of Hitler, in Italy of Mussolini, in the Soviet Union of Stalin, in Yugoslavia of Tito, the subsequent history of these countries is more about escaping that memory than embracing it. But without finding any other tutelary figures to replace them, the century of Adenauer, Brandt, Juan Carlos, Gorbachev, Andreotti, none of this rings quite true. The one exception might be Great Britain and Winston Churchill. But in fact, it is striking how little the memory of Churchill seems to loom in Britain today. Indeed, when President Sarkozy and much of his French government were in London in June this year to commemorate the 70th anniversary of the Appel du 18 juin, which is also the anniversary of Churchill's finest hour speech, delivered on the same day, the Churchill speech passed with remarkably little attention in this country. If Churchill's name is still deployed actively as a political point of reference, it is more likely to be in America, in Republican circles, than in Britain today. The difference might be that while Churchill's legend is associated with one moment in British history, de Gaulle's associations range more widely. The war, of course, but also the founding of the Fifth Republic in 1958, the ending of the Algerian War in 1962, and so on. But never works. Yes. But the poll already mentioned, if in the poll already mentioned, it's interesting to note that it is the de Gaulle of the war who is above all remembered. 44% associate de Gaulle with the Appel du 18 juin, 26% with the liberation, 20% the founder of the Fifth Republic, and extraordinarily, surprising to me at least, only 4% the decoloniser, that is to say 4% with the end of the Algerian War. So it is the image of de Gaulle and the war that seems to remain. Two images present themselves to the collective imagination in France when we think of de Gaulle and the war. The first, June 1940, a solitary figure, gaze fixed on the BBC microphone as if it was France. The second, August 1944, the liberator walking down the Champs-Élysées, watched by possibly 1 million people. C'était la mer, as de Gaulle famously commented. What made it possible to move from one moment to the other, from the solitude of 1940 to the adoring crowds of 1944, were, of course, the speeches on the BBC, that disembodied voice across the channel offering hope and an alternative to Vichy. It is usual to stress, and rightly so, that almost no one actually heard the speech of the 18th of June. But I think it is no less important to note how rapidly de Gaulle imposed himself on the collective consciousness of the French during the war, such that all resistance movements were obliged to take himself as their symbol. From almost the first days of the occupation, Vichy and the Germans began in internal documents and publicly to refer to all their enemies, those who weren't communists, indiscriminately as the de Gaullists. The first of Vichy's many show trials in the absence of the defendant was of the now ex-General de Gaulle in August 1940. And all this may paradoxically have had the effect of creating Gaullists where none had existed before. Vichy had its role in creating de Gaullism. Jean-François Crémieux-Briac, who was in London this summer, who was with de Gaulle in London, who was in London this summer for the celebrations, and indeed took President Sarkozy around the BBC in the summer, remembered recently on France Culture how he first heard of de Gaulle as the felon, the traitor. He was in a prisoner of war camp, and he heard about this felon, this traitor general in London, while reading a Pétainist publication in a prisoner of war camp, and immediately knew that it was the traitor in London that he wanted to join as soon as he escaped from the prisoner of war camp. No less important for the early success of de Gaulle is that he was unknown. He arrived in London with no baggage, both literally, one suitcase and the keys to a flat, but also metaphorically. He was a blank sheet on which the French could project their aspirations and expectations. He could be in their imagination what they wanted him to be. Indeed, some early resistors, as Pierre Lefranc recently told me, and Pierre Lefranc was one of the organisers of the 11th of November demonstration in Paris in 1940, many early resistors, like Lefranc, believed that the name de Gaulle must be a pseudonym. It was simply too good to be true that the man setting out to save France be called Gaulle. But of course de Gaulle was not a blank sheet in 1940. And if we take the trouble to read the four short books he published before the war, unknown to almost everybody in 1940, it is striking how much of what we call Gaullism was already there. The first, Discorcher l'ennemi, published in 1924, was a short study of why the Germans lost the war, and two ideas emerge. First, that what had gone wrong in Germany was a disequilibrium between civil and military power. The increasing dominance of Hindenburg and Ludendorff showed that the state had been too weak and the military too strong. De Gaulle was formed as a soldier, but one can read his entire career as a working out of the idea that the army must know its place as the instrument of civil power, and that this required the state to be strong. This was his view of 1940, which could be read as a kind of internal army coup against a deliquescent state. For those who might argue that this came oddly from a man who had come back to power thanks to a threatened military coup in 1958, de Gaulle would have answered that the problem of 1958 was that there was no state. That was his reading of the Fifth Republic, which explained why the army had been able to impose its policies in Algeria. And indeed, the first thing de Gaulle did in 1958 was to begin the long process of bringing the army to heel. A process which resulted, of course, in a military coup against him in 1961. As he once said, every time that the army interests itself in politics, it behaves like an idiot. Boulanger, de la Roque, Pétain, Salon. The second argument of discord chez l'ennemi is that the German military had become affected by an overweening hubris, an overconfidence about what could be achieved. A stance that de Gaulle opposed to the alleged French qualities of mesure, restraint, and control. De Gaulle used the classic trope of the ordered French garden as an embodiment of these values. And for those who rightly highlight the pursuit of national grandeur as one of the keys to Gaullism, and this was selected, if it's there, by interesting, and it is when you mention Gaullism, that is the thing that everybody thinks. One must also remember that for de Gaulle, the idea of grandeur, 58% of people associated with him, was always tempered by a pragmatic appreciation of what was realistic. It was for this reason that de Gaulle's judgments on Napoleon were very critical. It was Churchill, not Napoleon, who had a bust of the... It was Churchill, sorry, not de Gaulle, who had a bust of Napoleon on his desk at Chartwell. But of course, de Gaulle didn't have a desk at Chartwell, but he didn't have a bust of de Gaulle on his desk at Colombey. For de Gaulle, the problem with Napoleon, apart from the fact that he was ultimately serving an individual ambition rather than a national interest, was that he was that he was an adventurer, not a statesman. The problem with Napoleon was that he did not know where to stop. De Gaulle's second book, Le Fil de l'Épée, originally delivered as a series of lectures to the École de Guerre in the 1920s and published in 1932, was a rarefied meditation on the nature of leadership, developing a philosophy of action which emphasized the need for the leader to cultivate mystery and distance. The key idea of this book was de Gaulle's opposition to what he called a priori doctrines, his emphasis on the need for adaptability and pragmatic adaptation to circumstances. In particular, he was attacking the inflexibility of the official doctrine of the École de Guerre, but he also explicitly expanded this idea beyond military matters. He once wrote, in that book he wrote, "In politics, in economics, in war, circumstances are all." This philosophy of pragmatism was essential to de Gaulle's political practice, no less important than the intransigent defence of national interests, which is most generally associated with him. De Gaulle always had an idea he wanted to go, but he was infinitely flexible on how to get there. The third book, Towards an Army of the Future, is the English translation, Vers un Armée de Métier, is best known because it is now read with some justification as a prescient vision, if not quite as prescient, actually, as subsequently said by some people, of the nature of modern warfare, and a plea for the French army to adapt to the possibilities offered by modern military technology. But more broadly, this book also reveals another enduring feature of de Gaulle's thinking, an obsession with modernization, with the need to keep up or fall behind. Although de Gaulle is most famous for Une certaine idée de la France, the phrase which opens his war memoirs, his idea of France was never about preserving some timeless essence of Frenchness à la Vichy. It was about an existential struggle between nations in which to stand still is to die. That is what made De Gaulle so receptive in 1946 to Jean Monnet's vision for economic planning and modernization. The De Gaulle who said in 1961 that he wanted France to marry her century is already visible in the army of the future. And of course there's that famous speech where he talks about it is natural to feel nostalgia for the empire just as one can regret the gentleness of oil lamps, the splendour of sailing ships, but a policy that fails to take account of realities is doomed to fail. The last book, La France et son armée, published in 1938, was a history of France told through her army. It is in some sense the most instructive of the four books. It reveals de Gaulle's inclusive and ecumenical vision of France's history. Although he came from a traditionalist, Catholic, monarchist background, that book could never have been written by a Maurassian, that is to say Charles Maurras, Action Française, monarchist, who believed that French history had gone wrong in 1789. De Gaulle's vision of French history was syncretic, owing more to Barrès than to Maurras, and more to Peggy than to Barrès. Indeed, it seems to me that De Gaulle perfectly exemplifies that famous passage in Marc Bloch's book, Strange Defeat, where Bloch says, everybody would here know the great medieval historian who was a resistor in the war and shot by the Germans, but wrote this famous classic analysis of the reasons why France had lost in 1940. Bloch said there are two kinds of Frenchmen who will never understand the history of France. Those who refuse to thrill to the memory of the coronation of the kings of Reims, and those who read the Fête de la Fédération, read about the Fête de la Fédération in 1790 without feeling emotion. And de Gaulle was one of those who did respond to both those moments. De Gaulle's historical pantheon already before 1940, includes Lazare Carnot, member of the Committee of Public Safety. And indeed, in 1940, de Gaulle wrote to Renault and said, put me in charge, I will become the new Carnot. His pantheon included Carnot, Gambetta, Clemenceau, all key figures in France's Republican history, which is why his list would have been very different from that one up there. Once this is understood, the political evolution, the seeming radicalization of de Gaulle during the war, seems less surprising. Although de Gaulle had been careful not to make any ideological commitments before November 1941, it was only November 41 in the Albert Hall that he for the first time invoked liberty, equality and fraternity. His previous reticence, I think, had been tactical. He initially wanted to avoid being pigeonholed, and especially because most of the recruits, early recruits of the Free French, came from an extreme right-wing and often anti-Semitic background. And it should be remarked in parenthesis that one of the most extraordinary facts about de Gaulle, I would say, is his seeming imperviousness to anti-Semitism of any kind, something almost unique in France for someone from his milieu. What do de Gaulle's experiences after 1940 add to what I've identified as the key elements of his worldview before? I would suggest three. First, the obsession with the idea of national independence. For de Gaulle, the péché original, the original sin of Vichy, was its abdication of independence. And for him, all its crimes followed from that fact. Many historians would not agree with that today, but that was de Gaulle's analysis. That it was the signing of the armistice, everything follows from that. He also felt acutely the humiliation of his own dependence on the British between 1940 and 44. Secondly, it was only after 1940, and only after 1944, I think, that de Gaulle began to reflect on political institutions. That he believed in the need for a strong state, we have already seen. One could cite his famous comment, worthy of Tacitus as an epigram, on President Lebrun in 1940. And I'm always very pleased, any of my students who by the end of my course know who President Lebrun was, immediately get a first. His comment on President Lebrun, that as head of state, what he lacked was that he was no head and there was no state. But for de Gaulle, the institutional form that this state would take had not previously interested him before 1940. It was then the main theme of his speeches between 46 and 55, and a condition of returning to power in 58 was that he be allowed to reform the constitution. and the result of the Constitution was the current Fifth Republic. Having said this, I think that the precise nature of institutions was never of fundamental interest to De Gaulle. Indeed, he only ever seemed partially convinced that his constitution had resolved the problems it was supposed to, since his main argument against the election of François Mitterrand in 65 was that it would cause France to fall back into all the problems which the new constitution was supposed to solve. Where the Fifth Republic is concerned, De Gaulle's most important legacy is not the actual nature of the institutions, which, as cohabitation has shown, are in many respects very peculiar, but his style of governing. And it is in his style more than anything else, his desacralization of the presidential function, that President Sarkozy often shocks the French today and represents a real rupture with De Gaulle. Thirdly, De Gaulle derived from his experience of the war an exalted sense of his own destiny and of his bond with the French people over the heads of political elites who he believed had let France down in 1940. His contempt with elites always oscillated with his no less strong veneration for the great commis d'état, the great functionaries who were necessary for effective government. But there was no oscillation in his belief in his own destiny. Perhaps that idea had always been there. We have a story he wrote at the age of 15, imagining, the first text we have actually, imagining a victorious General de Gaulle at the head of France's armies. But then who hasn't written that when they were 15? But this theme of destiny becomes essential after 1940. It is about 50 pages in Itoui's war memoirs where he first sets foot on French African soil at Doula in October 1940 that the third person, De Gaulle, appears. And from this moment, De Gaulle developed this belief that he had in some sense become, in his person, the embodiment of the continuity of French history. What other political figure could one imagine him muttering, as De Gaulle was sometimes heard to do, "I've been saying it for 1,000 years. But how, if at all, did De Gaulle change that 1,000-year history? It seems to me it would be possible to write an account of 20th century French history in which little would have been different without De Gaulle. France would have been liberated, whether or not De Gaulle had existed. There would have been an internal French resistance that could have claimed a part in the resistance. A republic would have been restored after 1944. There would not have been a civil war or a communist coup at liberation. The communists didn't want that. Algeria would have become independent. France would have acquired an independent nuclear deterrent. It was indeed in preparation under the Fourth Republic. Without De Gaulle, on the other hand, France would certainly not have obtained a zone of occupation in Germany and might well not have obtained a permanent seat on the UN Security Council. Although this is less sure, the British would surely anyway have wanted France to return to great power status as a bulwark against Germany. But this raises another question. Even if these are achievements, was De Gaulle really necessary? Or to put it another way, were the positions that De Gaulle adopted actually required to achieve the aims that he set himself? Some of his closest advisers in London used to complain that at times it was necessary to remind him that he was supposed to be fighting Hitler, not Churchill. His relentless suspicion of the British in the Middle East during the war in 1941 and 1945 bordered on the hysterical and unnecessarily aggravated his relations with Churchill. His Machiavellian manoeuvring in 1944 to play the Russians off against the British achieved nothing. And if France obtained a zone of occupation in Germany, it was due to Churchill, whom de Gaulle had done everything possible to alienate, not Stalin, whom he had courted on a visit to Moscow in December 1944. As for de Gaulle's Algerian policy, it could be read as a series of humiliations and retreats. He struggled as long with the Algerian problem between 58 and 62 as his much reviled predecessors did between 54 and 58. But de Gaulle's achievement was not only or primarily in the making of history, but as much in the interpreting, or one might say mythologizing, of it. Algeria may have been a defeat, but de Gaulle managed, by words, to turn it into a kind of victory for French values, a necessary step for France's modernization, and an opportunity to replace a colonial past with a European future. Similarly, de Gaulle was more than aware of the large degree of bluff in his wartime actions. But bluff was part of the point. His aim was to put himself, and therefore France, back into world history between 1940 and 44. That is why he began writing his war memoirs almost immediately after resigning in 46. And similarly, within days of leaving office in 1969, you'd think he might want to rest, he had begun to write his second set of memoirs, of which only one volume and two chapters appeared, with a single-mindedness, energy, and discipline quite astonishing for a man of 78 who had spent 10 exhausting years in office. But for de Gaulle, writing his history was important as making it. Writing was indeed part of making it. And as he remarked to an aide in 1969, the French have rejected de Gaulle today, but you wait. In 30 years, you will see the growth of the myth. This was an accurate prediction, but also a bold one, because we must not forget that the century of Charles de Gaulle was no less the century of hating Charles de Gaulle, the century of anti-Gaullism. Other 20th century figures have been much hated. Jaurès, who was assassinated in 1914 on that list. Bloom, who was physically attacked in 1936 and lucky to survive the war. Jean Zay, who was murdered in 1944. But the levels of hatred directed at de Gaulle make these pale, I think, into insignificance. There were many people for whom hating de Gaulle gave a meaning to their lives. He was the subject of some 30 assassination attempts, two of which came within a whisker of success. I remember first witnessing this myself, sorry, not the assassination attempts, but the hatred, when I was spending a few months in France in 1972 before going up to Cambridge. I was invited to dinner by the family of a girl in Aix-en-Provence whom I got to know very well. Indeed, I still have a present she gave me, a copy of the Programme Commun of Communists and Socialists, which shows the kind of high-minded relationship we had. They had previously seemed to me a very nice, normal family, until at some point I mentioned at dinner the G word, de Gaulle. And within minutes, I had the impression of living in that famous cartoon of the Dreyfus Affair, where one picture shows a family sitting down contentedly to Sunday lunch, and the next, a scene of chaos with the caption, "They talked about it." In this particular case, the violence came from the fact, which I had not known, that the family were of Pied-Noir, French Algerian origin. And it is, of course, from those who could not forgive de Gaulle for abandoning Algerie Française that anti-Gaullism was most violent. But there were many other themes and variants, right-wing and left-wing, in the vast symphony of anti-Gaullism. There were those who believed that Vichy's armistice of 1940 had saved France from a worse fate, that Pétain had been attempting to protect France, or who believed that de Gaulle, by refusing a reconciliation with Pétain in 1944, had plunged the country into civil strife and ushered in the dominance of the Communist Party. This was the classic right-wing tradition of anti-Gaullism. But there were left-wing variants. There were those on the left who believed that de Gaulle was a threat to all the democratic traditions of French republicanism, whether because he was a closet monarchist, Bonapartist, or simply a soldier. This suspicion existed among many French exiles in London, including Raymond Aron, and was a constant thread of anti-Gaullism. Almost the entire political class opposed de Gaulle's proposal to introduce the election of the president by universal suffrage in 1962. Another important strand in anti-Gaullism was represented by pro-Europeans, who viewed de Gaulle as an anachronistic nationalist, overestimating de Gaulle of France's role in the world. Finally, we should not forget the anti-Gaullism, or at least the agaullism, emanating from the resistance, from those resistors who believed that de Gaulle had exploited and emasculated the resistance and used it for his own ends. And indeed, it is striking how ungenerous de Gaulle is to the resistance in his memoirs. These different traditions of anti-Gaullism weaved in and out of each other, creating curious convergences and unlikely alliances. It is not surprising that many who had venerated Marshal Pétain were among the defenders of Algérie Française. But this was also a cause defended by many former resistors, like Georges Bidault. Some of those who defended the memory of Vichy were not only nostalgic reactionaries, but shared the pro-European strand of anti-Gaullism, believing that Vichy represented a more realistic and less implausible vision of where France stood in the world. The figure who most perfectly represents the confluence of all these traditions of anti-Gaullism was François Mitterrand, whose ambitions to become premier in the Fourth Republic had been thwarted by de Gaulle's return to power in 1958. As a former servant of Vichy turned resistor, Mitterrand was one of those so-called Vichistos résistants who had sought a kind of middle way between the wartime intransigence of de Gaulle and their former loyalty to Pétain. His first meeting with de Gaulle in Algiers in November 1943 was icy, it's famous. De Gaulle said, "Why did you come in an English plane?" After the war, Mitterrand was also one of those resistors who believed, as he later put it, that de Gaulle had confiscated the moral capital of the resistance. Mitterrand was a committed European who rejected de Gaulle's suspicion of European federalism. He was also the man who had, in 1964, penned a famous polemic against de Gaulle's Fifth Republic, which he called the coup d'état permanent. Thus, Mitterrand, in his person, embodied Republican anti-Gaullism, resistance anti-Gaullism, Vichyite anti-Gaullism, and European anti-Gaullism. Just as a little comment here, I always think the perfect encapsulation of the difference between the two men is that for Mitterrand, one of the most important experiences of his life was the fact that he had been a prisoner of war in 1940. He escaped, but it was a very important experience. Whereas de Gaulle, one of the great humiliations of his life was that he had been a prisoner of war between 1916 and 1918, and not being able to escape. And I think that perfectly encapsulates the difference between them. And when Mitterrand met de Gaulle in 1944, he was the head of a movement of ex-prisoners of war in the resistance, and de Gaulle is alleged to have said, "Imagine a resistance movement of prisoners of war. You might as well have a resistance movement of hairdressers." So this was the fundamental difference in attitude between the two men. Yet it was in 1990, under the presidency of Mitterrand, that we see the myth of de Gaulle take on its present dimensions, making it possible, indeed, to talk of the 20th century as the century Charles de Gaulle. Even before Mitterrand, it is interesting to watch how de Gaulle's successors tried to contend with his legacy and situate themselves in relation to him and his memory. This can be best viewed through that key moment of Gaullist liturgy, the ceremony which occurred every year since 1945 in the presence of de Gaulle on the 18th of June at Mont-Valérien, outside Paris, where thousands of resistors had been shot during the occupation. For de Gaulle's immediate successor, Pompidou, what made this exercise especially perilous, attending the ceremony at Mont-Valérien, was that in the first 2 years of his presidency, de Gaulle was still alive, but chose to be out of the country on both occasions. The first time in Ireland, the second in Spain, and he planned, in fact, in 1971 to be in China, but he died before, finishing his tournée of those monstres sacrés he'd never met during his presidency, de Valera, Franco, and Mao. And the result was that the absence of de Gaulle at Mont-Valérien when Pompidou was presidency loomed over the events more than if he'd been present, which was, of course, his intention. Even after de Gaulle's death in 1970, problems of protocol arose, because de Gaulle has always entered the crypt at Mont-Valérien in his capacity as grand maître of the Order of the Liberation, of which he was the first and only holder. Initially, Pompidou decided he would not enter the crypt, because, as he said, "I am only Monsieur Pompidou." He was also handicapped by the fact that many Gaullists believed that he had betrayed the general by letting it be known that if de Gaulle lost the referendum of 1969, he would be ready to stand in an election to succeed him, undermining de Gaulle's indispensability by guaranteeing a Gaullist candidate to succeed him. The fact that Pompidou had been neither in the resistance nor in London during the war also made him an object of suspicion to many Gaullists, a situation exacerbated when, in 1971, it was revealed that Pompidou had discreetly pardoned the former collaborator, Paul Touvier. This led one Gaullist to describe Pompidou in 1971 as the grave digger of the resistance at the service of America, as Vichy had been at the service of Germany. On the 18th of June, 1971, Mont-Valérien, a group of Maoists, those same leftists who had so violently condemned de Gaulle in 1968, organized their own anti-Pompidou pilgrimage to Mont Valérien, showing already how potent the memory of Michael de Gaulle might become. In the end, Pompidou, who had wanted in certain foreign policy areas, for example, admitting Britain to the common market, to distance himself from de Gaulle, nonetheless played his own important role in laying the first stones of the posthumous Gaullist cult, when, under the beady and disapproving gaze of many Gaullists, including Madame de Gaulle's widow and son, he inaugurated on the 18th of June 1972 the huge Cross of Lorraine at Colombey. And Pompidou made a speech which encompassed the entire epic of Gaullism, stretching from 1940 through the terrible Algerian problem, the restoration of the independence of our foreign policy, the creation of new institutions which create liberty, which reconcile liberty and effectiveness, and so on. Thus, Pompidou made the 18th of June the commemoration not only of the Gaullism of the war, but of de Gaulle's entire career, as well as inaugurating a new site of Gaullist commemoration at Colombey. In the following year, 1973, the last before his premature death, Pompidou took the decision to enter the crypt at Mont Valérien, despite being only Monsieur Pompidou, on the anniversary of the 18th of June, thus officializing and nationalizing what had been previously a specifically Gaullist ceremony. And in this way, he inaugurated a tradition from which none of his successors could escape. Where Pompidou had tried to channel the Gaullist inheritance, his successor, the centrist, Valéry Giscard d'Estaing, the man who had said, "Oui, mais," in 1969, started his presidency determined to look to the future and dwell as little as possible on France's past. His most controversial act in this respect was his 1976 decision, in a spirit of Franco-German reconciliation, no longer to commemorate as a national holiday the ending of the Second World War on the 8th of May, something which he was obliged to backtrack on, given the outrage that ensued. Similarly, Giscard, while performing his role in what newspapers already were describing as the traditional ceremony of the 18th of June, accorded the ritual no particular importance. He got it over very fast. He performed his duties briskly, and indeed, he is the only president in the history of the Fifth Republic ever to have missed one of the Mont Valérien ceremonies. On the 18th of June 1975, Giscard was in Auschwitz, not Mont Valérien. 5 years later, however, Giscard was himself, for the 40th anniversary of the Appel and the 10th of de Gaulle's death, pulled back towards the past he had previously tried to downplay. This was partly because, on the eve of the presidential election of 1981, he wanted to court a Gaullist electorate which was hostile to him and loyal to Jacques Chirac. So Giscard announced that he would take the opportunity to make a speech at Mont Valérien, breaking a tradition that this was always to be a ceremony of silence. He was forced to abandon this idea when a number of compagnons of la Libération, made it clear that they would in that case boycott the ceremony. Instead, at a meeting organized at the Sorbonne by the Institut Charles de Gaulle on the 18th of June, 1980, Giscard made a somewhat fantastical speech in which he remembered his family huddled around the radio listening to de Gaulle on the 18th of June, 1940. This implausible historical reconstruction from a pretty Vichyard family was Giscard's way of linking himself to the Gaullist heritage. None of this was enough to save Giscard from electoral defeat, and his successor was, of course, François Mitterrand, the man so execrated by the Gaullists, and vice versa. At the first ceremony of Mont Valérien, attended by Mitterrand as president in 1981, both de Gaulle's son and his son-in-law, Alain de Boissieu, were notable by their absence. Indeed, de Boissieu had resigned from his position as Grand Chancellor of the Legion of Honour, rather than be obliged, as his position demanded, to confer the seals of office on the newly elected Mitterrand. Although Mitterrand scrupulously obeyed all the rituals surrounding the 18th of June, more noteworthy, I think, was the fact that for the 40th anniversary of the Allied landings in Normandy, he managed to preside over the ceremonies without once mentioning the name of de Gaulle, a subtle form of anti-Gaullism by omission. But things began to change in 1985, as the left began to take up the idea of de Gaulle as the rassembleur, figure of unity and consensus, in opposition to a Gaullist right which under Chirac had moved temporarily to a position of Reaganomic liberalism. This paved the way in 1990, the 100th anniversary of de Gaulle's birth, the 50th of the 18th of June, the 20th of de Gaulle's death. While the Gaullists were tearing themselves apart between supporters of Chirac, Debray, Pasqua, Seguin, for the figure of de Gaulle to float free from his supposed political followers and ascend like a balloon into a new sphere of legendary untouchability. The celebration of the 18th of June 1990 took on the appearance of a fête nationale, even if a formal request to make it a fête nationale had been rejected by the government. In addition to the traditional ceremonies of Mont-Valérien, Mitterrand unveiled a bronze plaque at the Arc de Triomphe, reproducing the Appel du 18 Juin. All day, on Place la Concorde, a huge 30-metre-high radio transmitter broadcast de Gaulle's speech to the population in Paris. There was no better indication of the degree to which, in 1990, de Gaulle now commanded a kind of universal